Hello, friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Before we take you to your favorite Sports History Network show, just want to tell you a little bit about some merch that you can pick up that represents your favorite SHN podcast. So far, there's t-shirts, coffee mugs, and even books from some of the authors that do podcasts right here on SHN. Who could buy something better than that than have the history right from the gentleman that you hear talking about it? But we also are adding things each and every day. And where's that store, may you ask? Well, it's at SportsHistoryNetwork.com. Up at the top, there is the SHN merch button. Click on that. It'll take you right to the store, and you can be representing your favorite podcast and show the world that, hey, on the swag that I'm using, it's the headquarters of Sports Yesteryear, Sports History Network, and my favorite podcaster, the Sports History Network store. Shop there today.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Hello Old Sports. We're going to spare you the usual lengthy intro because this is just a quick pre-segment before the episode. What we're going to do in this episode is pick a random team, a random year and a random team, and talk about this that particular team for about, you know, 45 minutes or so. This was an idea that Andrew had basically where he kind of just said that you thought we could do 45 minutes on basically any team in history.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought, you know, when we first started coming up with episode ideas. I was like, I mean, we could probably do an episode on any team and do an hour on it. So we just kind of have this in our back pocket for times when it's a little bit slower or just, you know, it's easy to do in October. We'll do World Series episodes in, you know, February. We'll do Super Bowl episodes. Once we get to a certain time of year, it's like, yeah, it's nice to throw these in every now and then because they tend to be shorter episodes by our standards. And, you know, the two we've done so far, you kind of, it's like quirky, I guess. You learn about some different things. So
it's a change
of pace. Some of them aren't things worth learning about.
But. It's a change of pace, and it's something that we would, you know, tell me. We've done so far, we've done the 2007 Arizona Cardinals, which was the year before they made it to the Super Bowl. And then we did, I think it was the 83, 84, maybe Utah.
I think it was 82, 83, but yeah.
Basically just right couple years before they went on that crazy playoff run of like 20 years with Stockton and Malone. So those of you listening to this already know what team is going to be selected because you can see the episode title and description, but we are as of yet in the dark, and Andrew has a random number generator up here, and let's get to it. So
all right,
what do we usually do? We usually do MLB 1, NBA 2, NFL 3, right?
Yeah, so we just do those three because NHL, really any team for us would be a random NHL team. So we may as well, just the pronunciations alone would show
45 minutes.
Yeah, would show our hand as not knowing what we're talking about. So I have 1 through 3 in the number generator for now. Like we said, MLB 1, NBA 2, NFL 3, correct?
Correct.
And we have 3. So we have NFL, if it's the 2007 Cardinals again.
I think
so
we would
3
call that a mulligan.
That was a wrestler, Blackjack Mulligan. So we will be picking an NFL team. Now, next we usually do year, correct?
Yeah, and I think we started last time with 1950. So let's do 1950 to 2022. 2023 season, not technically over yet, although it probably will be by the time we record. But let's leave the very current season alone and just do 1950 to 2022.
2002.
We could.
I swear to God, if I have to talk about that giant 49er game, I'm not going to be happy.
So you got some interesting things here. We talked about the Giants and the 49ers. You got the Bucks team with Gruden in his first year in Tampa. You got the Raider team they beat in the Super Bowl with Jerry Rice and Tim Brown, you know, two Hall of Fame wide receivers in the twilight of their career. You got the Patriots, the only year the Patriots didn't make the playoffs in the Belichick Brady years, I think ever, when other than the year that Brady was hurt. You got the McNabb Philly teams, lots there. We'll probably end up with the Redskins or something, but even so.
Well, there'd be some interesting things. So what we do is, well, I'll do 1 through 32 because that was the first year of the Texans. And then we go through the standings. So like AFC East, 1, 2, 3, 4, AFC North, 5, 6, 7, 8, like that, right?
Yep.
All right. So I'm going to do the number first, and then I'll pull up. I have the standings up, and we'll check who we're talking about.
Sure.
25.
So that's going to be whoever was first place in. Whether you did you AFC first or NFC first?
So we just drew the team that won the Super Bowl that year.
Tampa Bay.
Which is the 2002 Buccaneers. Yeah, which is not quite in the spirit of this thing. But I mean, can we really dismiss one because it's a team that's too good?
No, I don't think it is. And we did once upon a time do an episode on the history of Tampa Bay sports about 3 years ago. But nonetheless, this will be fun. It'll be a little bit of a deeper dive. There's definitely some interesting things going on there in Gruden's first year. So, yeah, 2002 Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
All right. So we will have that team and we will study up on them. And when we come back in about 30 seconds in this podcast and in whatever, a week or so in real time, we'll be prepared to speak intelligently on the subject.
Thank you all. Talk to you soon.
Bye now.
All right. Hello, old sports. Dan and Andrew back with you. You just heard our voices a couple of minutes ago, drawing this team, the 2002 Buccaneers. And now here we are back a week or so later to talk about them. Just to give sort of a quick recap, this is the third of these that we've done. We did the, I believe it was the 82-83 Jazz, I want to say, was our first one.
And it was either 82 or 83 Jazz.
And then we did the 2007 Arizona Cardinals and now the 2002 Bucks. So even though we sort of envision this as a way to go almost anywhere in the 20th or 21st centuries, we've sort of had a trend towards very, you know, relatively, you know, 21st century NFL teams.
Yeah. And I mean, look, let's be honest. This one, it was a little disappointing to get this team just because it's not truly a random team. I mean, it was random in that sense, but it's a team that won a Super Bowl. So, you know, it would have been more of a betrayal to the random team thing than to throw it out and find a different team. But it also does kind of, you know, the spirit of it was sort of to take a team that we didn't know anything about. But, you know, we got what we got. So we really need to, you know, we really need to do them justice. And, you know, I guess thankfully there is at least no, there's no shortage of source material on it like there might have been with some other teams we could have got.
And one other thing that I should note that we should note is that we do talk about this team quite a bit in one of our very, very, very first episodes way back in the over 3 years ago now at this point, which is crazy to think how long we've been doing this podcast. Mm-hmm. But we very early on, and this was admittedly back when I was getting things up and edited a lot more quickly. I think the world being basically shut down was helpful for that. And I was basically editing and getting these episodes up within, you know, less than a week after they posted. So when we found out the Rays were going to be going to the World Series in 2020, we did an episode on the history of Tampa Bay sports where we talked about the Lightning. We talked about the Rays, obviously, and then we talked about the Bucks, and I think we also talked about some of the potential baseball team moves to Tampa Bay through the years, the Giants and some others. And so we do talk a decent amount about this team in that episode, which at that point was the only Buccaneers team ever to win a Super Bowl. The Brady Bucks would win a couple of years later. So this team I guess you could say kind of a 1 year wonder. This is an interesting time as I was researching this. This is kind of an interesting time in football and really sort of an interesting time in NFC football because it's really dominated by a team, which is the Eagles, who despite being the powerhouse of the NFC for a lot of years, make it only to one Super Bowl and lose in that Super Bowl to the Patriots. But the Eagles are kind of the common theme that runs through this early 21st century NFC.
Yeah, they're in the NFC Championship game four straight years. They actually play three different teams from the NFC South in three of those years, three consecutive years, 02, 03, and 04. You know, you mentioned that the Bucs are kind of a one-year wonder, and they were certainly after this. Like, it was interesting because this was sort of, even though there was a lot of newness to this team, which we'll talk about, this was sort of the end of it as opposed to the beginning of it because, you know, and I know most people are familiar because we've covered it, but like, so they come into the league in 76, they're horrendous. They're 0-14, they're 2-12 the year after. They kind of quickly, you know, they have a little bit of a blip for a few years. We're in 79 after having gone 0-14, 2-12, 5-11, they're 10-6. They actually get to the NFC Championship game in 79 against the Rams. 81, they're back in the playoffs. They win the division. 82 in the strike shortened year, they're back in the playoffs. And then begins the stretch that sort of is what I remember them as when I was a kid, which is last place finishes. They had a stretch here. I'm just going to read. Starting in 83, they went 2-14, 3 out of 4 years. They went 2-14 in 83, 85, and 86. Jeez. They had 11 losses in 87, 88, 89, 90, they're 6-10, 91, they're 3-13, 92, 93, they're 5-11, 94, they're 6-10, and 95, they're 7-9. And finally, after 1995 is really where this story begins, which is going into the 1996 season is when the Bucs, who, again, I mentioned, you know, they've been in the league at that point 20 years, had really 2 years that could qualify as anything decent. And in 96, they bring in Tony Dungy. And I think it was after that first year, they ditched the creamsicle uniforms, which everybody kind of looks back on now. And I'm one of them and goes, those were gorgeous uniforms, especially compared to what they've had since. But they were so associated with losing that they almost had to get rid of them.
Yeah. And it was the type of thing where they were so unique. These uniforms were so unique from anything else, really, in any sport, and certainly in the NFL. And then the team was so bad. So you turn on a game and you automatically just associated those colors and those uniforms with just a terrible, terrible team. They're playing at Tampa Stadium, which is known as the Big Sombrero. That was its nickname. I'm guessing that might have been a Chris Berman thing, or if not invented.
But here's the thing. If you look at it when it's empty, it does look like a big sombrero.
And incidentally, just now, as I was Googling for some information on it, I Googled Big Sombrero, and the first three things that came up were just websites where you could buy Big Sombreros, which I thought was kind of funny. But yeah, so they're playing in this sort of weird kind of stadium that's, you know, been around for, that was there for, you know, years and years before the Bucks even moved into it. They stink, like you said. Tony Dungy, who is one of the first black coaches hired in the modern NFL, I believe, though I don't quote me on this, I believe the only one previous to him had been Art Shell, the legendary lineman for the Raiders, hired by the Raiders a couple years previous. So it was really a big deal. And Dungy was, more than anything, a defensive coach. And so he's the one who drafts, brings in all these guys, Derek Brooks, Warren Sapp, John Lynch, all of these future Hall of Famers coming into Tampa Bay, and they become sort of a perennial playoff team under Dungy.
Yeah, so 97 is the Dungy's second year with the team. In 96, they went 6-10. Which is easy to turn your nose up at, but then you realize it's really tied for the best record they'd had in about 20 years or about 15 years. So 97, they get to the playoffs for the first time in 14 years or whatever. They actually win a playoff game in the first round against the Lions before they lose in the divisional round to the Packers, who were on their way to their second straight Super Bowl appearance, and they ultimately ended up losing to Denver. The next year, they go to 8-8. missed the playoffs, but they're 8-8. Then 99, they go 11-5. They end up in the conference championship game. This was the game they played against the greatest show on turf, Rams. And do you remember what the final score of that game was?
I do, only because I was just watching this on the America's Game special on this team in preparation. It was 11-6. And there's something I want to get back to about that score. So, and I also, real quick, I should correct myself. Lynch is there before Dungy gets there. So Dungy does not draft Lynch. He drafts some of the other future Hall of Famers, doesn't draft Lynch. But yeah, the final score of this game. And this to me is kind of like emblematic of the problem with this team, which is that here they are, they shut down this offense that everybody had thought of as just unstoppable. They give up only 11 points to them. And keep in mind also that this is not a cold weather game here. This is in St. Louis in the dome, and they only they hold them to 11, but they can't score more than six. And so that, to a certain degree, has sort of drives home the message of, the defense is set, but they got to do something about this offense.
Yeah, Sean King is the quarterback for the Bucks that year. I have a tape. There was a wrestling pay-per-view that night. It was the first wrestling pay-per-view I'd watched since I got back into wrestling. And I had ordered it, and I was checking my tape that afternoon to make sure it would record. And I recorded the last couple of seconds of this game. So I have I forget, it's like literally 2 seconds of like Kurt Warner and Sean King shaking hands at the end of this game. You're right. They have these great defensive players, all pro level defensive players, you know, and they don't even have a competent offense. And at some point it becomes a thing of, you know, okay, Dungy has taken them from a perennial laughing stock. You know, this is also, we'll point out, they're playing in the NFC Central in this era. And really, since they came into the league with, you know, 1 or 2 years of exception, they're playing in the NFC Central, which is the current NFC North minus them. So they're in a division with the Bears, the Packers, the Lions, the Vikings, all teams that have natural geographic rivalries. The fan base is sort of, culturally are very similar in terms of, you know, Midwestern. Most of those franchises have been around for a very, very long time. The Vikings are the new kids on the block in that group because they've only been around since the early 60s. It's just a very different thing for them. You know, they're an odd fit in that division.
Yeah, they were very much. They were sort of like the Cardinals were in the NFC East, especially the Cardinals after they moved from St. Louis to Phoenix. They were very much the outliers in that division, and it's the same thing with Tampa. And I should note, it's actually 99 is actually not Dungy's last year. It's the following year, 2000, where they lose the wild card to they lose to Philly and they score 3 points. So the 2 years in a row, they're being eliminated in the, what's that?
Dungy's there through 01.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm missing a year.
We'll get to that.
All right. We'll get to that. Go ahead.
So in 2000, they're 10-6. They get to the wild card round. They lose to the Eagles 21-3. And for the first time, you seriously start to have rumblings that, okay, if he can't get, because this is the first time they've stepped backwards. You know, they made the playoffs, they got to the divisional round, then they got to the conference championship. Now they only go 10-6, they go to a wild card game. They're destroyed by an upstart at the time Eagles team, although that didn't last very long.
And keep in mind now, in two straight playoff losses, they've scored, two straight playoff elimination losses 2 years in a row, they've scored 6 points and then 3 points.
So there starts to be rumblings going into the 01 season that, hey, if they don't make any noise in the playoffs, there's a good chance that Tony Dungy's going to be fired. So again, in 01, they're 9-7. So the record takes a backslide again. They only finish in third in their division, but it's enough to get that last wild card spot, the sixth seed. They go to Philadelphia again. they're destroyed again. This time it's 31-9 is the final score. I was looking to see who started this game. I don't think it was still King at this point. It was Brad Johnson at this point, who I want to talk more about, you know, as we get into this team. But, you know, so this is now 3 years in a row they've been bounced from the playoffs without scoring a touchdown. 6 points, 3 points, and now 9 points. And, you know, and I know this is hindsight and, you know, oh, you're going to let Tony Dungy walk out the door. And it worked out fine for Tony Dungy as well. But it becomes a point where you start to say, is this the furthest he can take them? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think in coaching, especially in the NFL, sometimes it's just time for a different voice. And especially in football, where with some exceptions, you know, guys get to a certain point where they're just great coaches, you know, Andy Reid, you know, Belichick, you know, that level of guy, even Parcells. But at a certain point, guys spend a lot of time in their career. And I saw you make a face because I know what we're going to get into in a second here. But you guys are either defensive coaches or offensive coaches. And a lot of times you'll see one guy get shown the door and another guy get let in sort of in response to that. And usually it's when, and this is certainly not the case with Dungy, or maybe it is the case with Dungy. I shouldn't say that it wasn't, but you just don't know. And, you know, did Dungy go to Indianapolis and prove himself to be a better coach than they thought he was? Or did Dungy go to Indianapolis and end up working with Peyton Manning? And that was what got him. Hard to say, but at certain points, I think, especially when a defense has been built up and built up and built up, you then get to a point where it's like, okay, now we got to bring in an offensive guy to get the offense over the hump.
Well, it's at some point it's like, okay, we've now seen, if we were going to win a championship with a dominant defense and a bad offense, we'd have done it already.
Yeah.
You know, how much better can this defense be? So it's not an unreasonable thing. You know, nobody can argue that Tony Dungy didn't, you know, lift that franchise out of the doldrums. But it's also hard. And again, I know we're doing this with hindsight, but like, it's also hard to argue that keeping him in place, you know, would have produced the same results, because they, you know, the offense wasn't even serviceable. And, you know, unless you're going to just bank on, well, our defense is going to win us all these games, which, you know, proved that it wasn't enough. So, you know, it's hard to argue with the thinking. And the point I was trying to make, and I kind of lost my train of thought, they certainly gave him enough time. You know what I mean? He'd been in the playoffs 4 times in 5 years, but it, you know, at this point, they, you know, they've lost the wild card round 2 years in a row. They've been embarrassed. It's not unreasonable to think, okay, we've come as far as we can with this current configuration and mindset. So while this is going on, and this has happened with Tampa a few times, but this is the one that always sticks out in my mind. So Bill Parcells leaves New England for the Jets in 1997. He is the coach of the Jets, 97, 98, they get to the AFC Championship game. 99, Testaverde gets hurt. He leaves at the end of the year. He's in an executive role with the Jets, but, you know, not really. There's the whole Belichick thing. By 01, Parcells is back out of football. You know, he's back. He's not with the Jets anymore. And you start to hear rumblings. He's making himself known very clearly that he's interested. And I think, wasn't it before he went to New England the first time he played footsie with Tampa, didn't he, in 91?
Yes. Yes, he did.
So now here is the article. This is a UPI, United Press International, I guess, article. Tuesday, January 14th. Doesn't have an author. It's just UPI. Tuesday, January 14th, 2002. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers fired head coach Tony Dungy Monday, clearing the way for Bill Parcells to take over a team that consistently fell short of expectations. The firing of Dungy comes just 2 days after the Buccaneers suffered an embarrassing 31-9 loss to Philadelphia in the NFC wildcard. Reports surfaced that one day before the Bucs' latest playoff failure, that Dungy would be fired if Tampa Bay lost to Philadelphia, and that owner Malcolm Glazer had a tentative agreement with Parcells to be the club's head coach. According to reports, the hiring of Parcells would be delayed for 4 to 6 days while he finalizes contract details and begins the process of assembling a staff. I won't read the rest of the article, but it goes even into what they believe Parcells' contract structure looks like. It is, you know, very clear. The 60-year-old Parcells is no stranger to postseason success, coaching the New York Giants. He announced his retirement as head coach of the New York Jets in 1999 and last year resigned as director of football operations. Glazer has had an infatuation with Parcells since rumors surfaced at last year's Super Bowl that Glazer was pursuing him. However, Glazer decided to stick with Dungy for another season, although he refused to give him a contract extension, etc. So certainly from the point of view of this article, which seems to be representative of a lot of people's thinking at the time, the Parcells deal was essentially done.
Yeah.
And now I have an article. Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm looking at an ESPN article from the same time period, and here's how they phrase it. It says that the team is believed to be close to agreeing to terms with Parcells to succeed Dungy. It says the official hiring of Parcells will be delayed for 4 to 6 days as he finalizes contract details, talking about him maybe reaching out to a couple of potential staff members. So yeah, this is really, really close. Incidentally, from this ESPN article, there's a couple things on the sidebar, and one of them is Chris Mortensen saying, quote, Colts might come calling for Dungy, which happened. And then the other thing is, and when I click on the article, it doesn't go to the article, but the beginning of it is, it says the Panthers met with Giants .. And I have no idea what that would have been, but it must've been John Fox.
Yeah. Defensive coordinator, John Fox.
It was
yeah.
John Fox. That's exactly what it was. So this was close. This was considered. And I mean, you know, this is Parcells. I mean, sometimes I wonder if he just did this thing with Tampa because he liked living in Southern Florida and was like, hey, yeah, I'll coach them. And then when he actually had the opportunity or when it was actually time for him to put up or shut up, he always decided he didn't want to do it.
Well, it's interesting, too, because they, you know, clearly were looking for an offensive coach, but I guess they would have gone with Parcells just because he was Parcells. But so I have an article. The article I just read from was from January 14th. This is from January 19th. I accessed it via the LA Times archives, but it looks like it's just an AP article. Bill Parcells rejected the Tampa Bay Buccaneers again. The two-time Super Bowl champion coach said Friday night he will not return to the sideline with Tampa Bay or any other team. Bill Parcells early this evening told us that he would not return to coaching, Buccaneer Executive Vice President Joe Glazer said. In our continued pursuit of a championship, we remain confident, blah, 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 blah. Parcells, meanwhile, told CNNSI.com and Sporting News Radio that he wasn't able to make the commitment necessary to do the job. And here's the money quote on this. I hope that convinces everybody that I'm not coming back, because I'm not. This is it. I'm staying retired, Parcells told CNNSI.com from his home in New Jersey. The demands of the job and what it would take for me to succeed are just too much. And then it says this is the second time in 10 years that they've heard blah, blah, blah with Parcells. The first indication that the plan to hire Parcells was falling apart came when the Jets announced Friday evening that Mike Tannenbaum, thought to be Parcells' handpicked choice to be Tampa Bay's general manager, was remaining in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's how it came apart. Obviously, within a year, Bill Parcells was shaking hands with Jerry Jones and taking over as the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys. So he was never actually, I mean, I don't know if he believed it at the time when he said, I'm not coming back, but he was a year later, he was accepting another head coaching job.
Yeah. And I know this is not the topic of the episode, and we've talked plenty about Bill Parcells, including in our interview with Gary Myers on his great book, Once a Giant, from a few months back. But if you're a Giant fan, it's a prerequisite. You have to love Bill Parcells, but he is a guy who's just incredibly full of crap. He's so definitive in the things he says, and then will immediately just contradict those things later on and be equally definitive. So he's he's always been sort of that way.
So where that leads us to, and I have a pretty, I'm not going to read all of it, obviously, but I have a pretty good oral history from about 6 years ago, written by somebody named Jenna Lane at ESPN. It's with interviews from guys like Derek Brooks and Mike Allstott. It said, I'll skip the beginning part about Dungy basically realizing he was about to get fired. It said, meanwhile, in Tampa, the Bucks were struggling to find a replacement for Dungy. Bill Parcells opted to stay retired. They interviewed Baltimore Ravens defensive coordinator Marvin Lewis, LSU head coach Nick Saban, Pittsburgh Steelers offensive coordinator Mike Mularkey, and San Diego Chargers offensive coordinator Norv Turner. Tampa Bay general manager Rich McKay wanted Lewis, but the Glazers believed they had their defense already set with coordinator Monty Kiffin, and they wanted an offensive-minded head coach. Raiders owner Al Davis initially demanded 2 first-round draft picks, 2 second-round picks, and future Pro Football Hall of Fame defensive tackle Warren Sapp, who'd been NFL Defensive Player of the Year in 1999. The Bucks went looking elsewhere after talks with Niners head coach Steve Mariucci went nowhere. The focus turned back to Gruden. Bucks Vice President Joe Glazer and Davis reached a deal on February 17th, 2002. And then Gruden's quote here is, I had a phone in my house, and when that phone rang, there was only one person, Al Davis. He'd call at times when you'd expect Al Davis to call. So when the phone rang, I knew who it was. We had just lost to, I think, the Patriots in the playoffs. Oh, yeah, yeah. That would have been the Tuck Rule game. Mm-hmm. I was still bitter. I know he was still upset that game. I figured we were going to talk about that. The deal was done by February 18th. Trade was for 4 draft picks, first and second round picks in 2002, first rounder in 2003, and a second rounder in 2004, and $8 million. So that's how quickly it came together. Obviously, you know, I remember at the time, whether that would have still been Tagliabue saying something along the lines of, like, I'm not wild about this as a precedent with coaches getting traded, but like, we'll allow this in this case. It was something along those lines.
And it's funny that Sapp is the guy they talk about giving up. It's really kind of funny for two reasons. First of all, because after the 2003 season, Sapp actually leaves the Bucs as a free agent and goes to the Raiders. So he ends up there eventually. The other thing is, it probably wouldn't have been worth it to give up Warren Sapp, because you have this defense that everybody thinks is the thing that's set. You know, our defense is good. We need to concentrate on the offense. The last thing you want to do is get rid of possibly your best defensive player in service of that, because then all of a sudden your defense isn't quite so set anymore.
So that's sort of, you know, the major offseason thing. The other thing I wanted to touch on that did happen in the offseason was Warrick Dunn, who'd been sort of the, you know, they were a relatively anemic offense, but Warrick Dunn was their best offensive player on those Tony Dungy teams. Warrick Dunn leaves the team as a free agent. He signs with, I believe it was Atlanta. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the offense is obviously undergoing a major transformation now with John Gruden in charge, but they're also going to be without what had been their, you know, main halfback for the better part of a decade at this point.
And his backfield mate is Mike Allstott, who is kind of achieving sort of cult status as this sort of strong bull.
That was Dungy.
I'm sorry?
Dungy was the one who achieved cult status.
What? Took me a minute. cult status for anybody who might have missed that. Mike Allstott, who's sort of, you know, he's all Madden. He's the A-train. So he's really, you know, not a lot of fullbacks getting endorsement deals. But, you know, Mike Allstott, he's becoming really well known. And he's kind of their biggest offensive weapon during these years, which on the one hand sort of speaks to his skill level. But on the other hand, when a fullback in the modern NFL, and even like you can call 20 years ago the modern NFL, I think, is your best offensive weapon, you probably got some problems.
So let's talk a little about the rest of this offense. You got Allstott, who we just talked about. Michael Pittman fills in as the leading, kind of takes over as the leading rusher for Dunn once Dunn leaves. Actually, Pittman hadn't been on the team previously. He'd been with the Arizona Cardinals. He comes over with Tampa starting in 2002. I'll talk a little about Brad Johnson when we're done with this. The receivers for the 2002 team had been you know, upgraded from what they've been previously. There's Keenan McCardell, who comes over from Jacksonville. He had been one of the good, you know, receivers alongside, what was his name, Jimmy Smith?
Yeah, and those Coughlin Jacksonville teams, which were really, really good teams. They had been, what, playoffs a bunch of years. They were 14-2 in 1999 with Mark Brunell as the quarterback. This was a really good offense that he came from in Jacksonville. Yeah.
You look at this, Pittman's new to the offense. McCardell's new to the offense. Ken Dilger is new to the offense. He came over from Indianapolis. Offensive line, Roman Oben, Kerry Jenkins, Jeff Christie, Cozy Coleman, and Kenyatta Walker. The two guys I kind of wanted to touch on from an offensive standpoint that we skipped over, and those are just the starters. I'd have to look at, you know, other interesting names that are, you know, backups or things like that. Keyshawn Johnson is on this Buccaneers team. Keyshawn, who had been, you know, sort of burst onto the scene with the 1-15 Jets in 96, was there with Parcells, kind of a love-hate relationship. After the 99 season, I guess it would have been Parcells responsible for trading him to Tampa Bay, kind of exiling him from New York. And in 2002, he's 30 years old. He's never, you know, he's, has not lived up to what he looked like he was going to be in 1996, but he's still a very good, if difficult to deal with, receiver, you know, who's now got an offensive minded, passing minded coach.
Their third receiver is Joe Jarrovicius, who had been on the Giants as their third or fourth receiver in their Super Bowl team a couple years earlier. Jarrovicius ends up scoring a big, like a 76-yard touchdown in the NFC Championship game this year, then moves on a couple years later to go to Seattle and plays in a Super Bowl with Seattle in his only year there against the Steelers. The Keyshawn thing, a couple interesting things there. First of all, in one of the articles that I read about the potential Parcells hiring, this Parcells hiring that didn't end up happening was something that they were talking about even before the 01 season had ended. So they were talking about how Keyshawn was sort of very conflicted and emotional because he had a lot of respect for Dungy, but he was looking forward to theoretically potentially playing for Parcells again. The other thing, and this goes back to that 11-6 game, Keyshawn had sort of gone to Warren Sapp at the Pro Bowl, whether it was that year or, you know, at some point in the interim prior to this, I guess, it was that year because Keyshawn went in 2000. Keyshawn went to the Bucks. Keyshawn went to Warren Sapp and said, "You guys were 6 points away. You just needed 6 more points to make it to the Super Bowl. You should lobby for the Buccaneers to bring me in, and I will get you those 6 more points and then get you to the Super Bowl." So Sapp lobbies to bring the guy in. In this America's game that I just watched this afternoon, apparently things sort of soured between Keyshawn Johnson and Warren Sapp almost immediately because Keyshawn refused to show up to the quote unquote voluntary offseason practices. And Warren Sapp didn't take that well. He takes that as a lack of commitment to winning. And there's a funny sort of segment where Warren Sapp is, who was from Florida, is talking about how could Keyshawn possibly want to be on vacation. You know, he could come to Florida and be on vacation and go to Miami and go clubbing and go to Orlando and go to Disney and all these things. And he's like, you know, right away, he says that he kind of sours on Keyshawn Johnson because Keyshawn doesn't come to these offseason practices. And Keyshawn is, you know, he's a hard guy to like, I would imagine, as a teammate.
Yeah, and it blows up in Tampa with him the year after this in 03, where I believe eventually he gets sent home by Gruden, and you know, that's kind of the end of it. I think they bring him back at one point, but yeah, he was definitely a diva, you know, as we define that word with wide receivers. But he does have a really good year here. He catches 70 something passes for over 1,000 yards. The last guy I want to mention to sort of round this out is the quarterback for the offense, which is Brad Johnson, who, you know, Johnson, I don't think we're giving anything away here that they win the Super Bowl. Johnson obviously gets talked about as sort of the one of the lesser quarterbacks to win a Super Bowl. And, you know, that's, it's high praise to be in the group of quarterbacks to win the Super Bowl, but, you know, they always kind of throw him in there with Joe Flacco and Trent Dilfer and
Dilfer, who had been the Tampa quarterback up until a few years previous.
Yeah, and sometimes they'll throw Eli Manning in there, even though he won two. But, you know, you see those kinds of names get.
Well, they shouldn't throw Eli Manning in there. I mean, Eli Manning's going to the Hall of Fame.
Doug Williams and that sort of stuff. But like, you know, in the list of guys like that, you know, I don't agree with the Eli thing. I've heard it before. So Johnson,
you know what the other thing about Eli Manning is?
What's that?
He doesn't even have a mustache.
He doesn't have a mustache. He's too tall. He's too short. He's too thin. He doesn't have a mustache. He'll never have a mustache. That's a Letterman quote. So Johnson comes into the league with the Vikings in 1994, and he is up and down for a couple of years. He's the starter for most of the year in 1996. Then in 97, the Vikings are 8-4 under him, on their way to the playoffs. He gets hurt in the 13th game of the year. That's when I believe Randall Cunningham takes over after that in 97, right?
Yep.
So he loses the job to Cunningham in 97. He's on the bench in 98. He does start two games in 98, I'm sure, when Cunningham was hurt. Minnesota, you know, rightfully decides they're going to stick with Cunningham. They have that year they had in 99. So they send him off to Washington. And 99 is kind of the last good year Washington has for a very long time. They go 10-6. They win the division. Johnson starts every game. He throws for just over 4,000 yards. So he has a very good year, 24 touchdowns to 13 interceptions, leads them to the division title and to the playoffs. I don't know if did they win a playoff game that year or no. Let's see. Did they win a playoff game in 99? No, they did.
They
not
did. Redskins?
They did. Yeah, did they?
They beat Detroit and then lost in the divisional round to Tampa.
Okay, all right. So so 99 is that. 2000, the Redskins were supposed to be like the best team in football going into that year. And they had a pretty good year. Johnson starts 11 of the games. They're 7-4. I don't know if he lost his job or what happened in 2000. I think he might have lost his job, but basically Washington decides they're going to be done with him. And they would soon enough make their mistake of bringing in Steve Spurrier. So he probably got out of town just in time. That's right, because wasn't Schottenheimer the coach for just 1 year in 2000?
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, Schottenheimer was...
01?
Schottenheimer was 01. 2000 was okay. Norv Turner and then Terry Robiskie.
Okay. So anyway, so then they, you know, so then Washington decides they're done with him. So they send him to Tampa in 01. So at this point, he's 33 years old. He's had some good years. He's had some bad years. He's lost his starting job twice. It seems like, okay, they're going to send him down to Tampa. He'll be an upgrade over Sean King, but how much of an upgrade is he really going to be? And then, you know, he is the quarterback at 34 years old going into this 2002 season with Tampa Bay. So just kind of to set the stage for the offensive side of the ball for Tampa Bay.
And he's actually backed up by another Johnson, by Rob Johnson, who was the guy who had been with.
Yeah, fresh off his run as the starter in Buffalo when Wade Phillips made him the starter after Doug Flutie had been the starter all year
in 1999. Yeah. He benched Doug Flutie just going into the playoffs, and they ended up losing on the Tennessee, the Miracle.
Yeah. The Music City Miracle.
Music City Miracle. Exactly.
So that's the offensive side of the football. Defensively, I'm just going to read some of these names up front. They run a base 4-3. Booger McFarland and Warren Sapp as the defensive tackles, and Simeon Rice as. So, I mean, there's the guys who are on like the top line of this: Sapp, Rice on the defensive line, Derek Brooks at outside linebacker. And then the secondary included Rondae Barber and John Lynch. So that's five of your 11 defensive linemen, right? Or defensive starters right there that are, you know, tremendous players or all pros, depending on the year. And then there's a few guys on there like Booger McFarland and Dexter Jackson, Shelton Quarles, who are, and actually their other corner, Brian Kelly, had 8 interceptions that year.
It was always kind of an unfair advantage, though, with Booger McFarland, though, because he was able to use that cart. So
on Monday night, the Monday Night Football thing.
Yeah.
Like lift.
So 4 Hall of Famers on the team, and another guy, Simeon Rice, who in 02 might have the best year of any of them. He's an all pro. He has 15 and a half sacks, which I'd imagine would have to be one of the highest in the league. They've got 3 all pros on the defense, Sapp, Rice, and Brooks. And then they've got 2 more guys who are pro bowlers that year, and that's Lynch and Shelton Quarles, the middle linebacker. And then even though he's not an all pro or a pro bowler that year, you've got a future Hall of Famer in Rondé Barber at cornerback. So yeah, this is a really good, this is like a 2000 Ravens, 85 Bears, you know, one of these great all time single season defenses.
And just to point one thing out too with this defense, just looking at the Football Reference page with the ages, Booger McFarland and Dexter Jackson were the youngest starters on the defense at 25, and the oldest starters on the defense were Shelton Quarles and John Lynch at 31. So those guys are all in their prime. No rookies, no second year guys, but all, you know, guys who were in their 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th years. You know, a guy like Lynch was probably up in his 8th or 9th, but like, you know, no 35, 36 year olds, like they are all guys playing at the top of their, you know, at the top of their games going into that season. And they still have Monty Kiffin. They still have their defensive coordinator.
Derek Brooks ends up being the AP defensive player of the year. He's 4th in NFL MVP voting, which is really good for a linebacker. And at one point he scores 4 defensive touchdowns in 5 games, which is just incredible.
And I'll bring that up in a second. A couple other assistants on this team who are names worth bringing up. Rich Bisaccia, who was a Raiders interim coach a few years ago. Jay Gruden, who was the Redskins coach for quite a while. Right? He was in Washington. Yeah. Rod Marinelli, Raheem Morris, and then the defensive backs coach was Mike Tomlin.
Oh wow.
I think he went to Minnesota for like 2 years after this and then ended up going right into the head coaching job with Pittsburgh pretty soon after this. So, and, you know, some well-known defensive or assistant coaches.
And Jay Gruden is doing double duty. In addition to coaching with his brother's Buccaneers team, he is also playing quarterback in the Arena Football League during this season.
That's right. Yeah. And just to sort of round out the starters, because we didn't talk about them, the kicker is Martin Automatica Grammatica,
who is just tiny.
But he was a great, great kicker. And then who was the punter? Tom Tupa.
It was Tom.
The punter was Tom Tupa, 36 years old. So both really good in the special teams areas. You know, so they go into the year just to sort of set the stage, I guess. You know, you go into the 2002 season. Obviously, the Patriots had won the Super Bowl the year before, but in a way, a lot of people kind of thought it was a fluke. You know, I don't think anybody at the time thought, oh, well, the Patriots are clearly the team to beat this year. As a matter of fact, I think one of the big teams to beat in the AFC, like the preseason picks in 02, because 02 is kind of the first year I remember on this level. Like, obviously, I remember earlier seasons, but like where I remember like preseason analysis, the Dolphins. People really like the Dolphins in 02. I think that was the year they had acquired Ricky Williams. They made the playoffs a few years in a row before that. So people were high on the Dolphins. In the NFC, the Rams had been to 2 of the last 3 Super Bowls, and you know, most people considered them the best team in football the year before that in 01 when they lost. The Eagles showed they were a team on the rise. You know, so I think people probably thought, okay, the Bucs can be a good team. They're in the same division as the Packers, so that's going to be a difficult. Oh no, actually, that's the other point. We go into 02.
This is the year the Texans come in, right?
Yep. So the league expands from 31 to 32 teams in 2002, and we have realignment. So the Bucks are taken from the NFC South or from the NFC Central. They're taken out of that. They're paired with, I guess, what, two teams? Is it three teams from the NFC West? Yeah. The three teams in the NFC West who were all in the southeastern United States joined the division with the Bucks. That's the Saints, the Panthers, and the Falcons. And they populate what is now the new division, the NFC South. So the Bucks, you know, you go in, the Panthers, I think, had won one game in 2001. So they were not going to be considered a team that was very, you know, very dangerous. And the Falcons and the Saints and the Falcons at the time were teams who kind of had trouble getting out of their own way. So,
although the Falcons end up being really good this year, this is Vic's breakout year in 2002.
But the Bucks were probably, I'm sure, the favorites in that division going into it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the umbrella under which the season starts. Probably considered to be a playoff team, but, you know, is there any real reason to believe they're going to fare any better in the playoffs than they did in recent years? John Gruden's also, you know, he had taken the Raiders kind of out of their doldrums, but they hadn't, you know, 2000, they lose the AFC Championship game at home to the Ravens. 2001, they lost that game to the Patriots, which obviously, you know, Raiders fans will still not concede, you know, still and to some degree legitimately feel like they got screwed in that game. But it's not like Gruden's, you know, it's not like they had Bill Parcells, a guy who's taken a bunch of teams to Super Bowls or anything like that. So I don't know, is there anything you wanted to say before we get into kind of like the meat of the season? Or
no, I think you kind of touched on it. This is a very interesting time in football. Because nobody knew the Patriots were going to be a dynasty yet. The Colts with Peyton Manning had done very little yet. I know they'd been to the playoffs, but, you know, Pittsburgh, they didn't have Roethlisberger yet. It, you know, sort of the and the Rams, nobody knew it at the time, but the Rams were never going to be what they once had been. So this season especially is just a really strange one in the NFL. And I remember the AFC on the last day, the AFC East going down to like this weird thing, because it was like the Jets needed the Patriots to beat the Dolphins so that they would have a chance. But then the Jets winning whoever they were playing ended up knocking out the Patriots. It was a really sort of, and then in the NFC, like we talked about the Eagles, but there was no real, with the Rams gone, you know, you had, you know, not our favorite topic, but you had a Giants team that was good, that, you know, had a historical loss in the playoffs. You know, the Packers with Favre were still very good. You don't think of the Favre years as being this because, you know, he was done going to Super Bowls, but Brett Favre was still Brett Favre in those years. This was, you know, he's got five more good years with the Packers coming after this. So it's a very, you know, some of the, you know, Dallas was done, you know, some of these other teams that had been part of it, you know, in the 90s were out of it. San Francisco was a different kind of team now with T.O. and Jeff Garcia at quarterback. So this is and it's the only time that either of the Bucks or the Raiders make the Super Bowl in this era. You know, it's the first time the Bucks had ever made it, and they don't make it back for over 20 years, or I guess almost 20 years. And then the Raiders, after this year, haven't been to one since. So it's a very unique season, playoffs. You know, you're right on the cusp of, you know, Peyton Manning really coming into his own, of New England really becoming New England, of the Steelers becoming a perennial powerhouse again. It's an interesting, interesting year in the NFL.
So they go on a few runs early in this season. They lose in week one to the Saints, 26-20, but then they reel off five straight wins. And some of the teams they beat in this are impressive. They beat Baltimore, who had won the Super Bowl 2 years before, but had really dropped off pretty precipitously. They beat the Rams, you know, the Rams, who were the defending NFC championship, NFC champs. They beat them 26-14. They beat Cincinnati, who I think was terrible. They beat Atlanta on the road, and then they beat Cleveland to get to 5-1. But then in their first, you know, well, I guess you'd consider the Rams a big test, but then they go to Philadelphia in late October and they're beaten 20-10 by the Eagles, which A, gives the Eagles a big tiebreaker advantage over the Bucks for later on down the season if it comes to it. But, you know, even though they beat the Rams by this point, by the time the Eagles had beaten Tampa, the Rams had kind of fallen apart. So that win looked less impressive in hindsight. Mm-hmm. And then they follow it up with four more wins over Carolina, Minnesota, Carolina again, and the Packers. And that's an impressive win because, which we can talk about, coming down the stretch, the Packers had a chance on the last day of the season to get the number one seed, and they choked it away and ended up the number three seed. But, you know, so the defense is obviously carrying them. And the thing I remember about the reason I remember this defense so fondly, and I know nobody cares, but so the year this 2002 season, I was in an ESPN fantasy football league that I was in for a few years with a friend of mine's brother and his friends. And I think this was still the era where you had to pay to do ESPN fantasy football. So it wasn't like a thing that everybody was doing. And I had a team that not only did I win my league, I finished like number 20 in all of ESPN.
Oh, I remember this. Yeah.
Now, almost everybody had the same guys as me. That's why I was in the, like, but basically my tight end was what killed me because I didn't have a great tight end, but I had Rich Gannon, who was the MVP of the league. I had Priest Holmes and Tiki Barber. I had Hines Ward. I forget who else I had at receiver. But anyway, I had this Bucs defense. And this Bucs defense not only was killing people every week, like looking at some of these scores in their wins, I'll give you their points allowed. Starting with week two, shutout, 14 points, 7 points, 6 points, 3 points, then 20 in a loss to the Eagles, then 9 points, 24, 10, and 7. So through their first 11 games, they had only let up more than 10 points, I think, 4 times. So, and they were scoring on defense too, like you mentioned.
I think they scored 9 defensive touchdowns that year was what I heard.
There was a run at one point where they were scoring touchdowns. It felt like they were scoring defensive touchdown every week.
Well, yeah, like I said, Brooks himself 4 and 5 weeks. So,
mm-hmm. So, and we'll kind of look at the end of the regular season once this, you know, so they're 9-2. They lose to New Orleans again. New Orleans actually swept them. That would be an interesting thing, although I don't know how we would figure it out, but that'd be almost an interesting show. Topic once would be teams that swept Super Bowl champions. Would be interesting. Like, I know, for example, I know that in the 2011 Giants were 9-7, but I know the 2011 Giants got swept by the 5-11 Redskins. There probably wouldn't be too many, but it would be interesting.
What was it in 98? The Jaguars had what, beaten the Titans both regular season games and then lost to them?
So the Jaguars went 14-2 in the regular season and they got swept by Tampa. And then they won their playoff game. And then the 99 Jaguars played 18 games because they didn't make it to the Super Bowl, including playoffs and regular season. The 99 Jaguars went 15-3 and all three of their losses were to Tennessee.
That's what it was. That's what that was.
So they lose to New Orleans. They're 9-3. They beat Atlanta, which at the time was impressive because, like you mentioned, Atlanta's getting hot. And maybe before we get to the playoffs, we'll talk about, you know, sort of all of these teams. They beat Detroit to get to 11-3. They lose to Pittsburgh in week 16. And what this does is it makes it so that going into week 17, and I'll never forget this because of the Giants, there's three teams in the NFC with a chance to get the number one seed, which is basic. Or actually, I don't know if Tampa did have a chance. No, they must not have. So if everybody wins, Tampa's the 3 seed. If Philadelphia wins, they clinch the 1 seed. If Philly loses and Green Bay wins, they get the 1 seed. So on Saturday, the Giants beat the Eagles. So that knocks the Eagles out of contention for the 1 seed. The next day, the Jets beat the crap out of the Packers. So the Packers fall all the way from 1-3. And by virtue of Tampa shutting out the Bears 15-0, they get the 2 seed. So they get, you know, they don't get home field advantage throughout the playoffs, but they do clinch the bye. They finish with a record of 12-4, and they're the number 2 seed in the NFC.
Mm-hmm.
So just a couple of sort of numbers on this 2002 Bucks team at the end of it. They finish with, oh, sorry, that's the overall Bucks roster. I want, or franchise page. I want the 2002 teams page. The 2002 Bucks, from a ranking standpoint, in points, they were 18th offensive from a point standpoint. So, you know, certainly nothing to write home about, but not 27th or 28th.
Yeah, Gruden didn't do really that much that Dungy hadn't done, but so be it.
Well, let's see where they were the year before, where they were ranked. The year before, they were ranked 15.
Yeah, I was looking at it. He actually didn't bring about too much of an improvement. Now, obviously, your ranking is not just dependent on yourself. It's dependent on what other teams are doing. So it's hard to quantify. But you can't look at the numbers from one year to the next and say, oh, my God, Gruden just totally made this a much better offense.
I mean, if you really want to make the case for him, you'd say, well, they averaged a point more per game, even though they were a little lower. The difference was the defense, which was already, I think, 8th in points the year before, shaved 5 more points off their average. They allowed 12 points per game, 12.3 points per game. They finished, like I said, they finished 12-4. Just from some offensive numbers, just to kind of Brad Johnson started 13 games, Rob Johnson 2, Sean King 1. Johnson, you know, the numbers don't blow you away. He barely broke 3,000 yards, 22 touchdowns, but 6 interceptions. Managed to not, you know, they didn't need him to take a ton of risks with how effectively the defense was playing. Rushing numbers don't blow you away. Michael Pittman, leading rusher with 718 yards, Allstott with 500. Nobody else broke the 200 barrier. Leading receiver, I think it was Keyshawn. Let me see if I can get this.
Keyshawn's got over 1,000 yards.
76 receptions for 1,088 yards, which really dwarfs everybody else. But it's the defense. And, you know, it's the guys we mentioned. It's Brooks. It's Rice. Brooks is obviously, you know, 15.5 sacks. Was that, or who was it? Was it Rice who had the 15.5 sacks? Yeah.
Correct.
Rice with 15.5 sacks. Brooks had 5 interceptions in the game, in the season. And you look at how healthy they were. Brooks started all 16 games, Barber 16, Kelly 16, Dexter Jackson 16, Lynch 15, Rice 16, Sapp 16. These guys were all, you know, playing pretty much every game too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, I think a lot of people, you'd probably, going into the playoffs, I think you'd be hard pressed not to consider the Eagles number one. You know, the Eagles are going to have home field advantage. The Eagles are going to, they've beaten the Bucks. I don't know if they played the Packers that year, but they've beaten, you know, they were in the NFC Championship game the year before. The interesting thing with the 0-2 Eagles is a couple of things. One, the last 4 or 5 games of the year, they were without Donovan McNabb. He'd gotten hurt, and then Coy Detmer got hurt, so they went to A.J. Feely, who was playing well for them. Also, it's the last year at Veterans Stadium.
That's right. One of these
next 2 games is going to be the last Eagles game ever at Veterans Stadium. You have the Packers, who, yeah, they played horribly against the Jets in Week 17, but they were poised to be the number one seed. Favre was, you know, having a resurgence this year. You had, you know, the 49ers in the playoffs, although I don't think a lot of people were taking them too seriously. You had the Michael Vick Falcons. You had this Giants team that had won 4 games in a row. So the Bucs would have been considered probably not the favorite to win the NFC, but maybe first among equals behind the Eagles.
And the Giants, to be, you know, this is a team that had just been to the Super Bowl 2 years ago. It's basically the same team. It's basically the same defense. And they just added an all-pro rookie tight end in Shockey, Jeremy Shockey. So they're good too.
So let's just run it down real quick. Philadelphia, the number one seed, Tampa, number 2. The wild card games, the Giants against the 49ers in the 5-4 matchup, and the Falcons against the Packers in the 6-3 matchup.
All right, so that's the NFC. Did you want to talk a little bit about the AFC? Just sort of give a general idea, or?
Yeah, sure. So let's do that. And like you mentioned, it's a bit of a weird year because, you know, you're expecting, you think 2000s NFL and you think, oh, the Patriots and the Steelers and all that. And
Colts.
The Steelers. What's that?
Colts.
The Colts. Yeah. And some of those teams are involved, but not necessarily prominently. So Oakland kind of ran roughshod through this season. They, after losing John Gruden, they promoted Bill Callahan, who was their, I think, defensive coordinator. He must have been their offensive coordinator. He had been their offensive coordinator. They promoted him. So he's the head coach. They go 11-5. They're the one seed. Rich Gannon is the MVP of the NFL this year. He was just a machine. On the other side, you have Tennessee wins the newly created AFC South. So they're the number two seed. Steve McNair, you know, and again, they were in the Super Bowl just 2 years prior. The three seed is those Pittsburgh Steelers. Would this have still been Cordell Stewart?
He's with the Bears by this point.
Was it Tommy Maddox in 02?
And I'm wrong. Cordell Stewart is on this team, but maybe he's back with them. No. This is Cordell Stewart's last year with Pittsburgh before he goes to the Bears the following year. Cordell Stewart starts 5 games. Tommy Maddox starts 11. So I don't know. Okay. My guess is Stewart starts the year as quarterback and then it goes to Tommy Maddox. But
That is what happened. I guess I thought that was a year later. Mm-hmm. So you have the Jets who win the AFC East. Like we talked about, they needed to win they needed New England to win. And then they needed to win themselves the last game of the year, which they did. The 5 seed is Peyton Manning's Indianapolis Colts. And the 6 seed, and actually the only time they made the playoffs the first, 20 years they were back as a franchise, is the Cleveland Browns, just in their, 4th year back in existence after, the original version moved to Baltimore in 1996. But the Browns are the 6 seed. Those are your 12 playoff teams to set the stage.
And you should also note that this just shows you how much parity there is this year, especially in the AFC. The Browns and Jets are both 9-7, and in the playoffs, the Broncos, Patriots, and Dolphins are all out of the playoffs with a 9-7 record, which means that New England and Miami lost both the wild card and the division on a tiebreaker at 9-7.
Mm-hmm. So, like we mentioned, the team at hand is, and maybe when we get to the Super Bowl, I'll do the AFC. I'll just resume through the AFC playoffs when we get there. But in the wild card playoffs, on Saturday, Atlanta goes up to Green Bay and shocks them. And this was, again, I mentioned if Green Bay had beaten the Jets the week before, they would have been the one seed. They would have been off this week. Instead, they lose to the Jets. They go at home. Most people are not thinking Atlanta, this dome team, Michael Vick. I don't think the Packers had lost too many playoff games at Lambeau Field ever prior to this.
Mm-hmm.
And they, let me actually see, because this thing might say, I remember that being a big deal in this game. Packers. Yeah, this was their first home playoff loss ever. The Packers lost to the Falcons. Michael Vick hammered them in this game 27-7. So as soon as that game is over, it automatically, Atlanta's going to play Philadelphia the next week. No two ways about that. Atlanta's playing Philadelphia the next week in Philadelphia. So the next day, the winner of the San Francisco versus the Giants game will be going to Tampa Bay. And I'm not going to turn this into a thing about the Giants. The Giants are up 38-14 in this game. They're rolling. I do believe had they continued to roll in that game, they may have been able to play Tampa well. By the time it started to fall apart on them, even if they'd won, they were going to be screwed the next week. But San Francisco pulls it out. They have a big comeback against the Giants. They score 25 unanswered points. The Giants blow it at the end. Absolute calamity for the Giants.
Andrew has refused to ever even consider doing an episode on that game.
They'd have to win a couple more Super Bowls. Now, here's what I will say about that, and then we can move on. for as many fond memories as you have of sports as a kid, you get to a point where you start to enjoy a team or a game or something on like a different level. This was my first year enjoying the Giants as like an adult type fan.
Mm-hmm.
I was in what that would have been 11th grade. And, you know, where I was like, I was very, very into that Giant team. And they were really frustrating all year. And then they started to play well at the end of the season. They beat the Eagles in week 17. And look, in hindsight, would they have been able to win a Super Bowl? No. But I just, when they were beating the crap out of San Francisco, I really did think, okay, that, you know, at the time, Tampa was an unproven commodity in the playoffs. They'd lost a bunch of wild card games. I was really excited. And then the way they blew that game just kind of almost laid bare the whole thing that they were frauds. It's like you could see, like, when the, you know, you could see the man behind the curtain in Oz, in the Wizard of Oz, not an actual Oz. That I would rather watch. Oz is more enjoyable to watch than a replay of this game, by the way. But the one thing I will say, and I didn't watch this game the next week. I watched every other game. This did sort of underline the next week when, first of all, Philadelphia beats Atlanta on Saturday night. Vic, you know, is kind of comes back down to earth. Philadelphia beats them. So Philadelphia is going to their second straight NFC championship game. They're going to have they know for sure the last game at the Vet, you know, going into the divisional round, who knows, you know, we may not end up playing another game here. If we lose the championship game, win, lose or draw is going to be the last game at Veterans Stadium. So this under this umbrella, the 49ers and the Bucks converge in Tampa the next day. And I do remember being a little frustrated just thinking about this game, like, well, you can't tell me the Giants wouldn't have given San Francisco a better game than this. As the Bucks rolled over them from the start. Final score was 31-6. It was 28-6 at halftime. Joe Jurevicius and it was the next game he had a big play, but we'll talk a little more about Joe Jurevicius. But they forced 5 turnovers. They sacked Jeff Garcia 4 times. They kept the 49ers out of the end zone the whole time. Brad Johnson, who hadn't played the last month of the season, comes back, throws for just under 200 yards. Allstott scored 2 touchdowns, and the Bucs win handily. They hold the 49ers to only 228 yards of offense.
Yeah, this was, and like you said, it was really hard having the Giants having just lost to this team in such heartbreaking fashion, to have them put up so little of a fight against the Bucks the following week. And this is also this is one of my favorite Chris Collinsworth lines of all time. Very early in the game, Bill LaFleur, who's the punter for the Niners, has a 14-yard punt, and I'll never forget Chris Collinsworth saying, yeah, I'm sure his teammates are on the sidelines saying, hey, Bill, thanks a lot for that 14-yard punt.
This was the first year of the Buck, Collinsworth, and Aikman team, which, you know, obviously Collinsworth left eventually, and Buck and Aikman still do games together. Couple of notes on this game. Bucks scored more points in this game than they had in the 3 playoff games previously. Because if you think about it, that would have been 18 points total in their 3 previous playoff games. Mm-hmm. And also, after this game, Steve Mariucci was fired.
That's right.
Mariucci, who, you know, they'd gotten to the playoffs, they'd won the division, they'd gotten to the second round. He'd been their coach since Seifert left in whatever it would have been, 97, 98, maybe something like that. But he's fired, and the 49ers would not make it back to the playoffs for 9 seasons.
After having been there basically, you know, every year for 20 some odd years.
Yeah. I think from like 99 to 01, it might've been a little, or to 02, it wasn't every year, but before that it was. So with that, the Bucks win, you know, it's dominant, but again, you get the feeling, okay, have they really been tested yet? You know, they played a team who was lucky to be there, had to use all their energy to get there last week. they clearly the Bucks outclassed them. Now, not only are they going to play a much tougher team, they have to go on the road. They have to play a team that is going, you know, is A, better than them, B, beat them earlier in the season, C, is playing at home, and D, is playing at home in a game that the fans know is going to be the last game at their, and I use this word dripping with irony, venerated home stadium.
And the Bucks have never won a game in temperatures under 40 degrees in the entire history of the franchise going into this game.
Yeah, so it does not set up real well for this Bucks team. It seems like, all right, and you know, the Eagles thing of they lost the NFC Championship game the year before, but they lost it on the road. They lost it to the Rams. The thing that would set in over the next couple of years, largely due to this game of them being sort of, you know, choking in these games, hadn't been established yet, but it would 3.5 hours later. And I'll remember the game started and Brian Mitchell had a
Before you get to that, I just want to note that one of the things I saw in the America's game was that before in that week leading up to the game, Gruden shows his team a tape of a 1995 Bucks Eagles game at the Vet where the Bucks beat the Eagles and Cunningham was the quarterback. Gruden was the offensive coordinator for the Eagles. And so he wants to show them, hey, look, you guys can beat Philly in Philly. This organization has done it before. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I did not know that. So the game starts and Mitchell has a huge return to start the game. Brian Mitchell, who after this season would sign with the Giants and be horrible for them in 2003. He has a 70-yard return, and a couple of plays later, Deuce Staley runs in from 20 yards out. So it's 7-0. The Vet is, you know, going crazy. It seems like the Bucks are going to be outclassed. They get a field goal to make it 7-3, long field goal. Johnson on the ensuing possession after they force an Eagles punt. Johnson throws an interception. The Eagles are in good field position, but they don't end up getting anything on it. They punt. They pin the Bucks deep at their own 4-yard line, and the Bucks go on a long drive. They end up covering the whole field, 96 yards on a drive that only they went 96 yards on 7 plays in just over 3 minutes, and it was punctuated by a 1-yard touchdown run. So there must have been a huge play in there somewhere. And at the end of the first quarter, the Bucks have actually weathered the storm and they're ahead 10-7.
Yeah. So they're sort of turning back the tide and maybe showing that they are the better team.
So then the key play was a 71-yard completion from Brad Johnson to Joe Gervicius on 3rd-and-2 from their own 24-yard line. So I knew there was a huge play in there. And let's just pause for a second to talk about what was going on with Joe Gervicius at this point. Joe Gervicius, who we mentioned, had been with the Giants in 2000. I have an article from March of this year, so March of 2002, about 8 months before this. From Len Pascarelli at ESPN.com at the time. So the Tampa Bay Bucks announced Tuesday that Michael William Gervicius, the son of receiver Joe Gervicius, died Monday night. Oh, so this must have been in 03. So I'm sorry. This was a month and a half after this. I apologize.
But the baby had been born.
Yeah. Yes. So yeah. The younger Gervicius, born prematurely during the NFL playoffs last winter, battled the legion of health problems from the outset. So his baby was born very premature with, you know, very serious health problems to the point where I don't know that it was reported this way at the time, but it was, you know, a long shot that the baby was going to, you know, survive.
Yeah.
But this was all in the context of within the last few weeks, maybe even that week for Joe Gervicius. So
it was, baby was born like 5 days before the conference championship game.
So it's kind of an example of football doesn't make that better. The guy's son was still very sick and ultimately ended up, you know, not living very long, but it, you know, it it was a huge play from a guy who had a lot on his, you know, weighing on his soul at that point.
Yeah.
Second quarter. So the Eagles punt again, they pin the Bucs at the 2 yard line. They force a three and out. They get really good field position because it's a bad punt from Tom Tupa. They get a field goal to tie the game at 10. Bucs come back with an 80 yard drive this time. Johnson hits Pittman and Keyshawn, and then he hits Keyshawn again for a touchdown. So it's 17-10 late in the second quarter. McNabb takes the Eagles down the field to the 24-yard line. He gets sacked by Simeon Rice. It's a strip sack, and the Buccaneers recover the ball. So not only do the Eagles not get a touchdown, they don't even get a field goal because McNabb is sacked by Simeon Rice, fumbles the ball. And the Bucs sort of, I don't want to say miraculously, but very surprisingly, take a 17-10 lead into the locker room at halftime of the NFC Championship game.
And they're doing it with turnovers again. Not necessarily defensive scores, but defensive takeaways.
You can make up for a lot of problems with turnovers.
Exactly.
So Eagles start the ball with the third quarter. McNabb fumbles again. Rondé Barber tackles him. It's recovered by Ellis Wims. There's a fair catch interference penalty against the Eagles. So the Bucs end up, with good field position. They get a Martin Gramatica field goal. So now it's 20-10 late in the third quarter. McNabb, they have the ball at the Bucs 10, and McNabb throws an interception with 3 minutes and 12 seconds left in the game to seal the victory. It's returned 92 yards for a touchdown. So, you know, it was going to be a long shot anyway, down 20-10, but they're at least going to get a field goal there. They're going to have some time. And instead it's a pick six the other way. And I just remember watching this game, and I was delighted watching this game and just how quiet it was. Just when he scored and the reality set in that this is the last game we're going to be in this stadium. They've lost at home to the Bucs. You know, it was stunned silence in that building at that point.
And like you said, this is really where the whole idea that, and it gets even worse the following year, this is really where the whole idea that this Eagles team cannot get over that last hump and make it to the Super Bowl. This is really where that starts.
And I don't know when this was written, but it says in a Sports Illustrated list of the worst losses in Philadelphia sports history since the city's last title in 1983. So somewhere between this and 2008, this game was published in 2008. So actually probably just before the Phillies won the World Series, this game was ranked first as worst loss in the 25-year drought era for the city of Philadelphia.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what else would have been on there? Mitch Williams, I guess, would have been is the other one that immediately comes to mind.
Well, you could have had the next year for the Eagles. You could have had the Super Bowl for the Eagles in 04. You could add some individual games. It's tough when you say worst losses, 'cause you're talking about series.
Yeah.
You know, if you're talking about, mm-hmm. And the Mitch Williams game would have been up there, but like you're talking about an individual game that the Flyers lost in a Stanley Cup Finals, or does it have to be the whole series or whatever? But So with that, the Bucs are on their way to their first Super Bowl. They sort of have, I think at this point, anyone who was doubting whether they were good enough, and I think they were still underdogs going into the Super Bowl, but you know, there was no doubt they were capable of winning a championship after having just gotten into that environment. They got the cold weather monkey off their backs that they couldn't win a game under 40 degrees. And their opponent is going to be the Oakland Raiders in a very interesting wrinkle, because John Gruden, who had been there the year before, is now going to be playing his immediately prior team with most of the same players and a lot of the same coaches, and something else the same that probably shouldn't have been in the Super Bowl. The AFC playoffs, just to break down how it went. In the wild card round, the Jets beat Indianapolis 41-0. Cleveland blew a big lead to Pittsburgh, and people forget that Pittsburgh had a big comeback that day because that was the early game on Sunday, and like 3 hours later was the Giant 49er game that was a bigger comeback.
Yeah.
The next week you had the Titans over Pittsburgh in an overtime game, 34-31 in Tennessee, and the Jets over Oakland, or excuse me, Oakland over the Jets, 30-10 at the Oakland Coliseum. So the AFC went totally chalk. The 3 seed won, the 4 seed won, the 2 seed won, the 1 seed won. And then in the AFC championship game, Oakland against Tennessee, which, you know, in an era where the AFC championship game was New England against either Pittsburgh or Indianapolis, it felt like every year, this was Oakland against Tennessee in the middle of it. And Oakland wins 41-24 to set this matchup for Super Bowl 37. This would have been in San Diego.
And you mentioned that Gannon is having an MVP year. Just generally, this is a the offense for this team, for this Raider team, you figure you got two future Hall of Fame wide receivers, Tim Brown and then Jerry Rice, who admittedly is, you know, a little bit past his prime. He's 40 years of age, but nonetheless, the guy's got 92 catches for 1,211 yards. Brown's got almost 1,000 yards receiving. This is a really good, high-powered offense. And the Raiders are favored going into this. They're not favored by much. I think they're favored by like two. But they're still, they're favored. This is not expected to be, well, Tampa Bay is just going to roll over them.
The sort of the big story outside of Gruden that came up this week, which is you know, kind of sad, and it's very sad in hindsight, but center for the Raiders, who was a Pro Bowl center, Barrett Robbins, basically went AWOL the day before the Super Bowl. He was admitted to San Diego Hospital, then spent time in rehab, subsequently diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and his disappearance was later, you know, revealed to be due to a manic episode. Robbins said he'd gone across the border to Tijuana, spent his partied in Tijuana, was so disoriented that he thought the Raiders had already won the game and was celebrating the victory. So he did not play in the Super Bowl. And didn't he end up dying pretty young? Or no, I'm sorry. He's still alive. I could have sworn I read that.
Yeah, according to Football Reference, he's still alive. So hopefully,
yeah, he subsequently got in a lot of trouble with drugs and things and all that. He was actually a first team All Pro in 2002. So, you know, a sad story and you know, certainly different than a lot of pregame hype kind of things. But you know, that was the big news sort of surrounding this game. The other thing I will say about this game on a personal note is a very significant game for me personally in my football watching history. And do you know what that is?
Was this the first time you ever went to Andy's place at the Mini Meadowlands? Yes.
This was the first time I ever went to Andy's house to watch a football game. And since I was talking about the Giants, he said, oh, you should come back next year. And the rest is history, as they say.
And you still watch Giants games at his house on occasion, even to this day.
Even living in Connecticut now, I do, yeah. So,
and Andy, for those of you who maybe occasionally listen to Andrew's Split Decision Facebook Live show, Andy is a host or a caller occasionally to Andy's show, to Andrew's show. He also was a Andrew's co-host on the Unsportsmanlike Conduct show he did on Pauling Public Radio for years. So, Andy, good guy, and somebody who's sort of been in the orbit of our broadcast endeavors through the years.
Couple of broadcast related notes. ABC's got the game. It's Michaels and Madden. It's their first Super Bowl together. Madden is calling a Super Bowl for consecutive years. He's the first person to announce Super Bowls on different networks in consecutive years, because the year before he had been with ABC or with Fox, excuse me, with Summerall. The Super Bowl, this was the first of three. In the calendar year of 2003, ABC had the Super Bowl, the Stanley Cup Finals, and the NBA Finals. So they had all three of those in like a 7 month span.
I remember that because I think the Nets and the Devils were both in the finals of their respective sports, and both were on ABC and both were at the Jersey Meadowlands.
Yep. So the the game itself is, you know, when you consider the time of this, you know, the time frame of Super Bowls surrounding it, with how many good games there were. We just did our best and worst Super Bowls thing a few weeks ago, episode. There's a lot less to go into blow by blow in this game. You know, the Raiders start out, Johnson's intercepted early in the game by Brad Johnson is intercepted by Charles Woodson. Rice sacks Gannon. Oakland kicks a field goal. It's 3-0. The Bucks pretty much from then, Johnson hits Jarvicious. He hits another pass to Jarvicious. Pittman has a big gain, and they tie it at 3. So is it 3-3 at the end of the first quarter?
Hold on. I'm looking at it now. It is at the end of the first quarter. It is 3-3.
Yeah. So it's 3-0 at the end of the first quarter. Bucks score early in the second to make it 6-3. A couple of plays later, Dexter Jackson has another interception, making Jackson the first player ever to record two interceptions in the first half of the Super Bowl. Again, the Bucks don't take advantage. So this game is closer, I guess, pretty deep into the second quarter. Raiders couldn't move the ball. They punt. Bucks get great field position. Eventually they hit, Allstott hits a 2-yard touchdown to make it 13-3. They get the ball back with just under 4 minutes left, a couple of big catches, and they punch it in just before halftime, and it's 20-3. So it was, you know, 6-3 halfway through the second quarter, but the Bucks scored 2 touchdowns, make it 20-3. The Bucks had an 89-yard drive that took almost 8 minutes off the clock. And by the time Johnson hit McCardell for a touchdown to make it 27-3, that was pretty much the end of it. To add insult to injury, there was a pick six by Dwight Smith of Rich Gannon to make it 34-3. And that's pretty much it. The rest of it was really running out the clock. We ended up with a 48-21 final score. But, you know, once it was 34-3, I think it was pretty safely over.
It was. I guess you could say the Raiders threatened a little bit in that they score three. Starting at the end of the third quarter, the Raiders score 3 touchdowns in about 10 minutes of game action. They miss the conversion on all three of them. So it's 34-21, but it could easily be a 1-score game. And then they get the ball back and they're driving. Now, even if they had scored here, they would have needed to get an onside kick. But they throw a pick six, and then just for good measure, they then throw another pick six. And Derek Brooks scores yet another defensive touchdown.
Gannon was picked off 5 times in this game.
Yeah. So it's sort of, it's a game that's close for the beginning, and then the rest of it, they sort of, I don't know what you'd want to say. It kind of flirts with being close for a little while, but
and I didn't even remember that it flirted with being close, to be honest.
Yeah, I remember feeling a little bit like, oh hey, you know, they could at least make it. I feel like if a team is theoretically going to line up for an onside kick, maybe, you know, that's at least something. The MVP is Dexter Jackson, who has 2 interceptions for 34 yards. I'm curious why he was the MVP and not Dwight Smith, who also had 2 interceptions. What am I looking at here? Did Dwight Smith score? He scored at least once. Yeah. Why was Dwight Smith not the MVP of this game when he returned 2 interceptions for touchdowns? I know the last one was with 2 seconds left, so maybe a lot of the voting had already gone in, but
probably, I'm guessing.
He won a Super Bowl, so you don't want to feel too sorry for the guy, but he got screwed. He had just as many interceptions as the guy who beat him out, but he scored touchdowns on both of his.
So the last thing we should talk about with the actual game is the stories about the Bucks knowing the Raiders plays. Yeah. And I think for years, the way this was told, was that the Raiders didn't even bother to change their calls, like didn't bother to change their cadences and their audible calls and stuff like that. I think the more accurate thing, and I see a quote here from Mo Collins, I'm assuming from the Raiders, not the actress from Mad TV, said, "You never played a football game where 95% of the plays, the other team, they can guess what plays you're running based on scheme. But these guys, we was breaking the huddle and they was calling out our formation and bossing over to our formation." So it seems like it wasn't that they knew based on what audibles they were calling. It was that it was the same offense. So they were intimately familiar with, okay, they're in this formation, they're going to do this. They also knew what Gannon's tendencies were because he had gone over them with John Gruden over and over. So I think there's plenty of blame to go around there, but I think people have for years basically only put it on Bill Callahan. And look, he deserves a lot of criticism, but what he doesn't seemingly deserve criticism for is that, like, he was having the guys call out plays like,
yeah,
in the same code as the year before. So
there was a little more thought going into it than that.
Yeah, but it was, I think it was just that, well, this is my offense. I know my offense. You're running it with the players I ran it with last year. Mm-hmm. I know when they come out in this look, this is what they're going to do.
Yeah.
So exactly. I think, which I mean, again, is bad, but it's not. You were only going to be able to avoid that to a certain extent. You know what I mean?
Maybe not how it's been portrayed. Yeah.
But yeah, but I mean, I think that permanently, you know, dragged Bill Callahan down, and he ended up being, you know, staying on as a coordinator assistant for a very long time, but he never really got another head coaching job, I don't think.
Yeah, but what was he supposed to do? I mean, first of all, you take over this team. He had been on the staff, right, Callahan?
Yeah, he was the offensive coordinator.
Okay, so you got this offense. You have an amazing year. Rich Gannon is the MVP. You got two Hall of Fame receivers. You make it all the way to the Super Bowl. There was no bye week this week, so you only got 1 week to prepare for the Super Bowl. What were you supposed to do? Give your team a whole new scheme in 6 days?
No, that's what I mean. I think it was less. Yeah. So just for reference, Callahan was the coach one more year and got fired. Coach at Nebraska for 4 years. Then he was the Jets offensive line coach for 4 years. The Cowboys offensive line coach for 3 years. Redskins offensive line coach for 5 years, basically. It was actually the interim head coach for Washington, I guess, the end of the 19 season when that must have been Jay Gruden got fired.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And then he was the Browns offensive line coach the last 4 years and is now still in football. He's going to be starting in 2024. He's going to be the Titans offensive line coach. He's only 67 years old. So he was only in his 40s when he was coaching that team.
Hey, give the guy credit for sort of
sticking
with. I got to say, though, to go from coaching in the Super Bowl to then not a lot of coaches who appear in Super Bowls 25 years later, 20 some odd years later, are still just kind of bouncing around the league as an offensive line coach for mediocre teams. So the guy's a football lifer, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we don't need to get too far into it, but, you know, we mentioned the Bucs didn't really sustain this too well. They fell apart in 03. I know by 05, they were back in the playoffs, but I think they lost in the second round. Or no, I think Washington beat them in the wild card round. And then from there, it was, you know, they were in the playoffs in 07 and the Giants beat them. But, you know, it was a totally different team for the most part by then. They lose Warren Sapp to Oakland pretty soon after. Did he leave right after the 02 season?
One more year. He leaves after 03.
Okay. You know, I'm not sure how much longer Brooks and Rice and all those guys were there, but they never seriously contended for a championship again.
Never win more than 9 games. Even some of their playoff years, they're not. They're not. Now, Brooks is a Tampa Bay lifer. Brooks is there all the way through 08. Still playing at a pretty high level, and I guess Rondé Barber's there the whole time too. But some of these guys, Sapp goes. Barber's there. Yeah, Barber's there his whole career through 12. Is John Lynch there, or does he end up going somewhere else? John Lynch goes to Denver, where he, you know, plays in, he, you know, 4 more years as a Pro Bowler, 4 years with the Broncos, 04, 05, 06, 07. John Lynch is a Pro Bowler every year. For some reason, I just, in the back of my mind with him.
Oh yeah, well, I was thinking maybe just because of now, but yeah. So is, you know, it, the 85 Bears are their own class of team. Is this team, was this defense as good or close to as good as the 2000 Ravens?
I think they were definitely just as good at scoring. They had more Hall of Famers. I mean, the only two Hall of Famers on the Ravens team are Lewis and Ed Reed. It can be a hard thing to quantify it. Let's just look real quick, because it's not hard to compare. Mm-hmm. It's not hard to compare teams that were
two years apart.
So let's just take a quick look here. 2002 Buccaneers, and then the 2000 Ravens. We tend to do numerical comparisons more when we do baseball, so this will be a little bit. This will be fun. So the Ravens were first in points allowed, second in yards. The Bucs were first in both. The what else here? So I mean, from that point of view, the Bucs, I guess, are technically a little bit better. Bucks are third in turnovers. Raiders are first, so that's a little bit better.
Ravens.
What did I say? Raiders.
Yeah,
Raiders are first. I'm trying to see.
Hit it again. Ravens.
Ravens. I'm sorry. I'm trying to see here if I want to see turnovers. Where each ranked in turnovers. Okay, so there you go. Oh, I just did turnovers. I was trying to see touchdowns. That's what I was trying to see. I was trying to see. Okay, they were. I can't find that. I can't see which team scored more defensive touchdowns. Although I'd have to imagine that the Ravens didn't have the 9 that Tampa Bay had. So I don't know. I'd probably take Tampa Bay. I think Derek Brooks, people don't realize just how damn good he was. He wasn't Ray Lewis, maybe, but he was really close. And Sapp was, you know. You got two sort of all-time great defensive players in Sapp and Brooks on that front seven. So, yeah.
Simeon Rice was a hell of a player, too, in that time frame.
That year especially, yeah. I'd give the Bucks a slight edge. Not overly so, but I would say that they're probably slightly better. Yeah, just by.
And I don't know where I ultimately land, but the point is, it's a discussion.
It is. So, good team, great team for a single year. Exciting defense, and you know, an interesting story, obviously, with Gruden going back and playing against his old team in a Super Bowl. So, the random number gave us another interesting story. So,
yeah, it gave us a little more to work with this time. But, you know, it was certainly good to have a team that to talk about that probably wouldn't have gotten its own episode at any point, but is certainly worthy of one. So, you know, part of me was a little disappointed, but let's be honest, we had plenty to talk about here where we may not have with with the 1971 Indians.
And I hadn't thought about this 02 football season in a while. And it does bring back a lot of interesting memories of what that season was like. And sort of all of the teams that had sort of interesting roles to play in that whole story. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, this is random team number 3. We've done 3 of these episodes now. They're always a lot of fun. And I'm sure at some point over the next several months, we'll do another one. So this was your idea originally. And I think it's proven itself to be a good call.
Yeah. And hopefully we get real crazy with the next one and make our lives tough. But yeah. But we'll see. So thank you to the 2002 Bucks for giving us plenty to work with.
We need an obscure baseball team from like the 20s. We need like the 1924 Reds or something like that. So
Yes.
All right. Well, good show. We did almost 2 hours on this, which is not at all surprising. And thank you for and just on a personal note, having been in bed all day with the flu yesterday, I made it through. So kudos to me. And
just so everybody knows, when he said he was in bed with the flu, he made that motion with his thumb and his pinky like he was hungover.
Well, we'll catch you next time with another episode on something less random. But until then, I'm Dan Newman.
And I'm Andrew Newman. Goodbye, old sports.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Join George Bozica, the president of the PFRA, and myself, John Bozica, each month for the Professional Football Researchers Association official podcast. We'll discuss the history of the game, the many names of the game, and so many different things for you, making the history of football not only entertaining, but fun at the same time, as we join you on the Sports History Network on the official PFRA podcast.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.